So anyway, ladies and gentlemen, that does mean that everything is online, and we are going to go ahead and play some intro music because it's great. Episode of Stage 1 for May 6, 2024. Hope you had a great Cinco de Mayo, had a good weekend. Good to be with all of you today. 217-688-1433. You like to be on the program, and the more you talk, the less I have to. So please do give us a call. A lot in the news today, fine members of the Agenda Binary. That means all of you, by the way. Donald Trump has been threatened with jail time over this gag order in his fraud trial in New York. Now, what I mean by that is that the trial's a fraud, is what I mean. He had the fraud trial, and that was a fraud too. But there, you know, he was on trial for fraud, and now he's charged. He's on trial for falsifying business records because he was an extortion victim. He was a blackmail victim by a pornographer, a porn actress, I should say. And so for being blackmailed, he's being put on trial in New York. And they said, you better shut up because we don't want you talking about us. And Donald Trump was like, I don't think that you could do that. I'm the president of the United States. And the judge was like, well, you know, I don't care if I destroy the presidency. What I care about is you're not allowed to mention the corrupt process that's going on here. And so Donald Trump didn't really think that that was such a great idea, obviously. And I can sympathize with that position. And so he's been talking, and he's been getting fined, and the judge is realizing, like, oh, you know, I'm like, I'm fining a billionaire thousands of dollars, and he's telling me to go F myself, so what am I going to do? And it seems like what they're considering doing is putting Donald Trump in jail, possibly Rikers. And let me pull this up here, because this one is a new headline that came up since I had sent out the email this morning. Apparently, he says he's ready to go to jail over it. Let's play this video clip that's in this article. I haven't actually seen it yet. Let's see.
My life is full of
this questions. Is an no, advertisement. Yellow, I don't want to listen to an advertisement. I want to see Donald Trump make a statement, idiots. Former President Donald Trump made his usual post-trial statements in Manhattan on Monday, but this time he risked being thrown in jail if he violated Judge Juan Merchan's gag order for an 11th time. Trump began by denouncing the prosecution's contention that they would need 2 to 3 more weeks to present their case before he railed about the gag order. The judge is so happy about 2 to 3 more weeks because... Here we go. Now let's see if we can listen to what Donald Trump had to say.
More weeks. That means they want to keep me off the trail for 2 to 3 more weeks. Now, anybody in there would realize that there's no case. They don't have a case. Every legal scholar says they don't have a case. This is just a political witch hunt. It's election interfering. And this is really, truly election interference, and it's a disgrace. It's a disgrace. And in every poll, I'm leading by a lot. And they figure maybe they can do something here. Maybe they can do. This case should be over. This case should have never been brought. By the way, Alvin Bragg didn't want to bring the case. Your previous DA didn't bring the case. The FEC said they threw it away. They said, you got to be kidding. Southern District didn't bring the case. Nobody brought the case. And then Alvin Bragg brought the case as soon as When I'm running and leading, that's what they decided. Let's go bring a case. So it's a disgrace. But we just heard 2 to 3 more weeks. I thought they were finished today. And they are finished today if you look at what's happening. I thought they were going to be finished today, and they want 2 to 3 more weeks. The judge asked them, and playing right into the judge's hands. The judge is so happy about 2 to 3 more weeks. Because they all want to keep me off the campaign trail. That's all this is about. This is about election interference. How do we stop it? And it's a disgrace. And then you have the other thing that maybe is even more disgraceful is the gag order, where I can't basically, I have to watch every word I tell you people. You ask me a question, a simple question, I'd like to give it, but I can't talk about it. Because this judge has given me a gag order and said you'll go to jail if you violate it. And frankly, you know what? Our Constitution is much more important than jail. It's not even close. I'll do that sacrifice any day. But what's happening here is a disgrace, and the appellate courts ought to get involved. New York looks so bad. The New York system of so-called justice looks so bad between this judge and Gorin and Kaplan. You triple team with corrupt judges. It's a disgrace to our nation. So I should be out there campaigning. And they said, two, and the way I look at it, they're really talking about 3 weeks more. And by the way, they didn't even have enough to fill out the time. You know, we got out early today because they didn't have another witness. The government didn't have another witness. So they didn't even have time to fill it out. And then they complained. So I'll tell you what, I hope you report the story accurately. This is a real threat to our country. And it's a serious threat to the Constitution. In the meantime, Columbia University announced today they're not going to have their graduation. They're not going to have a ceremony. And that's happening all over the country. Our country is a mess. And the most important day in the history of our country is going to be November 5th of this year. That's called Election Day. It's going to be the most important day in the history of our country. What's going on with this judge is a disaster. Between the gag orders and the hatred he's got for me. And everybody sees it, okay? And you see it. You see it better than anybody. God bless the USA.
The Stormy Daniels liar.
And so, this is completely nuts. You know, you go throw Donald Trump in Rikers Island. You know, now I don't think he'd stay there very long. And he'd obviously not just be thrown into general population, but still, you know. The judge is so happy about 2 to 3 more weeks because all they want to do is keep me off the campaign trail. That's what this is about, Trump continued. And have the other thing that maybe is even more disgraceful is the gag order you just heard him say it. Judge Merchan found Trump in contempt for 10th time Monday and added a pointed warning about the possibility that he could order the former president to be incarcerated, saving the $1,000 fines he has imposed were not effective. Merchan's order read in part, quote, "Therefore, the defendant is hereby put on notice that if appropriate and warranted, future violations of its lawful orders will be punishable by incarceration. It is hereby ordered that the defendant pay a $1,000 fine for his violation of this court's lawful order not by the close of business on Friday, May 10, 2024. It is further ordered that if the offending statement has been posted to the defendant's Truth Social account or his official campaign website, it is to be removed by 2:15 p.m. Monday, May 6, 2024. Quote, "The magnitude of this decision is not lost on me, but at the end of the day, I have a job to do," Merchan said in court on Monday. "So as much as I don't want to impose a jail sanction, I want you to understand that I will, if necessary and appropriate." So what does anybody think is going to happen if they throw Donald Trump in jail? Whether it's for contempt of court, you know, if they throw him in jail for contempt of court, he'll probably be out the next morning. What do you think is going to happen if they decide to sentence Donald Trump to prison time? What do you think is going to happen? I got a kick out of this story. Not this one. Excuse me, where'd that go? I'm sorry. I'm just, I have the story up and I'm trying to find which one it is because this is pertinent to the issue at hand. The big joke. So a fellow by the name of Jacob Kushner, writing at the Telegraph, publishes a piece today titled "The Rise of White Terrorists Who Set Out to Kill Minorities and Immigrants." Because, you know, if you pay any attention to the news, you know that that's happening all the time, right? It's all the time, just white terrorists running around killing people. One autumn afternoon in the German city of Zwickau, a woman splashed 10 liters of gasoline around her apartment, then set it on fire. She had been dreading this day for years, hoping it wouldn't come to this, but on 4 November 2011 it did, and she needed to act quickly to save her two cats from the flames. Their names were Lily and Heidi. She scooped them up, put them in their carriers, and walked downstairs to the street. A passing neighbor recognized the woman by her strikingly long dark hair. Everyone seemed to fixate on this feature, perhaps because nothing else about her appeared distinct. She was 5'5", the average height of women in Germany. Her face was wide, flat, expressionless, and thin lips and gray-blue eyes. Later, when her face became famous across Germany, there was one trait that nobody seemed to use to describe her, which was strange because it was the only one that mattered. The woman was white. German investigators appealed for knowledge of Beat Schaap with this photo in 2012. She would later claim that she had waited to set the fire until the two men renovating the building's attic left for a break so they wouldn't be hurt, that she had tried to warn the older lady who lived downstairs, who sometimes looked after the cats, buzzing at her door to tell her to run from the flames. She'd taken great care, her lawyer would add, to save lives the day she set the fire, the lives of other white Germans. She wouldn't have needed to set the fire if only the 15th bank robbery had gone as well as the 14 before it. For over a decade, her two best friends and sometimes lovers had been robbing banks at gunpoint across Germany. In that time, they'd stolen hundreds of thousands of Deutschmarks and euros, worth nearly $1 million today. For their 15th heist, they drove 2 hours from Zwickau to Eisenach, one wearing a gorilla mask, the other a mask from Scream. They pistol-whipped the bank manager, then pedaled away on bicycles with €72,000 in a bag, then loaded the bikes into a white camper van and drove off. Hours passed without any sign of them, but at 4 minutes past noon, police spotted a white camper van parked a few miles north of the bank. The two officers approached it. Just then, they heard a gunshot, then another. The officers took cover, then the van went up in flames. Firefighters rushed to the scene and extinguished the blaze. Inside, laying on the floor with a Plitter 91 submachine gun, a Czech-made semi-automatic pistol, and a black handgun nearby were the bodies of two bank robbers, each with a bullet through the head. After setting the van on fire, one of them had shot the other, then turned the gun on himself. When news reports began circulating about what had happened, one person in Germany knew who the men were, the white woman with the cats. She knew that they weren't just... she knew they weren't just money-driven men with a death wish, knew that while robbing banks had been a talent of theirs, it was only a means to a more sinister end, murdering immigrants to keep Germany white. They weren't merely bank robbers. The woman knew they were serial killers, terrorists. She knew it because she was one, too. Over many years, in many cities, they shot immigrants where they worked and bombed the neighborhoods where they lived, shot them in their corner stores, kebab stands, a hardware shop, bombed them in a grocery store, a barber shop. German authorities didn't catch on to what they were doing, perhaps because they couldn't bring themselves to believe that 60 years after the Holocaust, some white Germans could still be radicalized to the point of carrying out racist mass murder. Police blamed immigrant crime syndicates instead. And meanwhile, men of Turkish and Greek background continued to be murdered one by one. 13 years passed before the trio's violence finally ended. After setting fire to their home in an apparent attempt to destroy evidence, the white woman ran before turning herself in. Beat Schaap's 5-year trial would captivate the country and reveal that she and her friends, Uwe Mundlos and Uwe Bonhard, had formed the core of a much larger terrorist cell called the National Socialist Underground. Germany's reckoning unfolded in a courtroom in Munich, packed with former right skinheads, former far-right skinheads, and former leftist punks. In 2018, Schaap was found guilty of 10 murders and being part of a terrorist group. 4 supporters were also given jail terms for their roles in helping the National Socialist Underground. The case would force Germany to grapple with what drove a seemingly ordinary woman and her seemingly ordinary friends to carry out a serial assassination of innocent people, people selected for the country from which they came from, their accents, the color of their skin. It also revealed an epic failure by German law enforcement to monitor neo-Nazis and recognize their racist attacks. I have spent 8 years investigating this case in the world of Germany's white supremacists. It quickly became apparent that the three friends were not predestined to become killers. It was the culmination of their decade-long indoctrination into Germany's far-right world. They didn't radicalize alone, but as part of a white supremacist community. In Eastern Germany, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, far-right youths called themselves National Socialists, Nazis. They refused to participate in their nation's collective shame. As far-right Germans saw it, there was nothing to atone for. For a German teenager with a penchant to provoke, nothing could be more incendiary than becoming a Nazi. Mundlos, in particular, relished the role, embracing anti-Semitism and expressing it through dark jokes. And by the time he and others in the core National Socialist Underground trio were coming of age, Nazi nostalgia had gained a foothold in Jena, a small city in the state of Thuringia. With his political dogma, Mundlos gave Bonhard's brashness a purpose that vindicated the young man's predilection for violence. Those who knew Bonhard tended to describe him in the most explosive of terms. Bonhard was like a bomb, a loose cannon, who failed at school, stole gasoline and cracked cars, then took them on joyrides. Later, those who knew Schaap would be unable to put a finger on what sent her down the violent far-right path. While she had right-wing leading, so did many Jena youth at the time. Quote, "We hated the state, the foreigners, the left, just about everything," her cousin Stefan would recall. "The original Nazis, too, but there was a difference. They'd chosen their far-right path at a time when most people around them were doing the same. Millions of Germans were complicit in the Holocaust, even if not all of them participated directly. But Schaap embraced white supremacy at a time when her countrymen did not. She befriended others who did the same, and together they tiptoed across the line between extremist speech and violence. Like the original Nazis, they blamed minorities for all their ills. They despised Jews and didn't consider them part of the white race. They derided blacks, but above all, they fixated on immigrants, working class men and women and children from Turkey, Vietnam, and Greece. Turks are S, Africans are S, everything is S, Bonhart would bemoan. To the three friends, these immigrants posed an existential threat to the white nation they wanted Germany to be. After it all ended, a country that liked to think it had atoned for its racist past would be forced to admit that violent prejudice was a thing of the present. The National Socialist Underground would compel Germans to acknowledge that terrorism isn't always Islamist or foreign. More often, it's homegrown and white, and in an age of unparalleled mass migration, the targets of white terrorism are increasingly migrants. A few months after the verdict, in October 2018, Katharina Koenig-Preuss, a German activist and politician in the Left Party, followed some 700 white supremacists to the town of Apolda, Thuringia, for a neo-Nazi music show. As she photographed the event, she could see in the distance the smokestack of the Buchenwald concentration camp, which the two youths, which the two U's visited in Nazi uniforms. The two U's, U-W-E-S, what is this, my cousin Vinny? I don't get it. It enraged her to watch these new Nazis pick up where the NSU trio had left off. As the gravity of the NSU's terror had begun to sink in, Thuringia's lawmakers had formed a committee to investigate the group and their network. Koenig-Preuss had secured herself a seat. Although her committee didn't have the power to indict anyone or press charges, it could still summon people to testify. Koenig-Preuss and its other members used this power to peel back the layers of what German authorities had ignored about the NSU. As to the question of who should be held responsible, Koenig-Preuss's committee concluded that Thuringia's authorities had acted with sheer indifference to finding the three fugitives, and that the state intelligence agency's delays and refusals to share intelligence with police may have amounted to deliberate sabotage and deliberate thwarting of the search. It was part of a damning report of institutional failure. But all of Thuringia's legislature could do was compensate the NSU's victims. Quote, "This monetary compensation cannot be regarded as adequate redress," Koenig-Preuss said, "but we would like to demonstrate that we are aware of our responsibility." For those whose loved ones had been murdered, the money did little to ease the pain. Ever since burying her husband in Turkey, Elif Kuba, and this is very poorly formatted, sorry, and someone else felt torn between two worlds. "Part of me is in Turkey, part of me is in Germany," they explain. "Germany is my home, but Germany is also the country where my husband was murdered." Just like Adil, wife of Enver, another victim, Let me just show you what I'm looking. I can't believe these things. You know, look at this. This is what I'm stumbling all over. Cuba, ampersand, C-E-D-I-L, semicolon, ampersand, I-N-O-D-O-T-K, semicolon, K. Like, this is in Yahoo News from the Telegraph, and this is what I'm dealing with. And it's ridiculous because nobody does their job in 2024. It's all over. Others, such as Tulun Uzudu, wife of Abdurrahim, who was slain in his tailor shop in Nuremberg, determined to stay. Officials in Nuremberg placed a large stone engraved with the names of the murdered men in the city's center, one of several memorials erected by cities across Germany to commemorate the NSU's victims. But in the weeks after the verdict, some memorials were vandalized with graffiti, presumably by the NSU's Nazi admirers. Now, this goes on pretty long, and I'm just going to stop here and just point something out, okay? We're talking about something that there's 10 murders were committed by three people over the course of a number of years, and the verdict was handed down in 2018. It is currently 2024, and this story is telling us about the rise of white terrorists who set out to kill minorities and immigrants, and telling us that this happens far more frequently than migrants committing terrorism. Well, that's actually obviously not true. That's actually like facially preposterous. And this gentleman with the last name of Kushner is completely shameless, and so is the Telegraph, and so is Yahoo News. And they don't even bother to, you know, fix the formatting of the text because, you know, it's complete nonsense anyway. Why bother editing it? What does anybody really think is going to happen in the United States if Donald Trump is thrown in jail following a trial? If he is convicted of a felony and sent to prison, is there anybody who actually thinks that that's going to turn out well for anybody? The only reason that you would do that is to tear the country apart. It has nothing to do with Donald Trump, as a matter of fact. You're trying to create terrorism. You're trying to create chaos. You're trying to destroy the presidency. That's what they're attempting to do, and it's obvious. Caller, you're on Surreal Politics. What can I do for you today?
Hey, Kent. Well, I was wondering if you noticed the change in the protests that are going on in the college campuses. You have frat boys dressed in all-American attire fighting the founder protesters now.
I have not seen that, actually. You have frat boys are now fighting the anti-Israel protesters?
Yep, and they're wearing, like, all-American flag attire. They're holding up their American flag and stuff.
Well, that's just comical, you know. I mean, I'm all for if they, I'm sympathetic to their desire to go beat up left-wingers, but it's kind of funny to go dress up in American flags and then go beat people up for Israel, I'd say. Kind of silly.
Well, yeah, they also have the Israeli flag. They're holding that up. Israeli flag and American flag, and they're beating up the anti-Israel protesters. And on Fox News and the conservative media outfits, they're saying, oh, this is patriotic. Trying to complete, you know, fighting for Israel,
right?
Fighting for America.
Oh, well, that's hilarious. So I had not seen that. That's pretty funny. You know, the idea that, this would be pretty funny if it works out, right? So if those guys get away with their criminal behavior, I mean, you know, it's basically all bets are off, right? We're like, okay, you can go and you can go and attack, you know, the alt-right in the street. You could go and attack Donald Trump supporters. You won't go to jail. If you defend yourself against those people, you're a criminal. We'll throw you in prison. And then if you decide to go protest Israel, then we'll go send, you know, misguided right-wingers after you, and they'll come out dressed in American and Israeli flags, and then they'll commit crimes, and we won't punish them. And if we start seeing leftists going to jail for defending themselves against that stuff, I mean, you know, there'll be a very poetic element to that, and I won't shed a tear. But, you know, I do feel bad for the guys who are misguided enough to go and, you know, fight for Israel on a college campus and commit crimes for a foreign government.
Yeah, you can see videos of it on X, Twitter. I'm not calling it X, just Twitter. You can find all these videos on Twitter, and they're like right-wing Antifa, and like they're not going to jail. But ironically, the anti-Israel protesters that are fighting back are the ones that are getting arrested. So it is quite the sight to see. It's like the complete opposite of what happened a couple of years ago.
Yeah, this is, you know, in that sense, it's good. You know, I mean, it's not good, but it's one of those things that might be the best you can hope for at this point, right? That okay, the left is going to get a taste of their own medicine. They thought they were invincible, and they decided to take on the state of Israel, and now they're being shown that they are in fact not invincible, that they are far from it. And so I thank you very much for the call, my friend. 217-688-1433. If you'd like to be on the program, and the more you talk, the less I have to. So please do give us a call. I'm scrolling through my Twitter feed here to see if I immediately catch any of this. It's not popping up immediately in my Twitter feed. And so I'll keep a... Oh, is this? Columbia lawsuits are demanding... Yeah, okay. Well, we'll see what transpires with all that. Let's go take a look at our stream chats. Yeah, Secret Service will go with him to the cell, says Tom on Odyssey. That's probably the case. this is hilarious. I just go over to Rumble, and it's still playing the advertisement because I've had the tab closed. Okay. So that's good. Rumble is working indeed. All right, so I can see myself on Rumble. That's great. 217-688-1433 if you'd like to be on the program. And the more you talk, the less I have to. So please do give us a call. So Donald Trump's talking about, I'll go to jail. And, you know, when he goes out and he makes that statement to the media, he's like, yeah, the judge, the prosecutor. And that's the whole entire thing. You're not allowed to talk about them. So there's a really pretty good possibility that that's actually going to happen. And once they do that, once they cross that line, I mean, you can't, you know, that's the Rubicon right there, you know. And they don't care. They're destroying the presidency because they're monsters. 217-688-1433 if you'd like to be on the program. And the more you talk, the less I have to. So please do give us a call. So here's a piece in the Jerusalem Post, which is maybe not the most objective, you know, news source when you're talking about these things. But there's a story. Hamas accepts the hostage deal. Israel sends team to Cairo and continues Rafah op. President Joe Biden and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had a 30-minute phone conversation following the evacuation of Palestinians from Rafah. Hamas's acceptance of a Gaza ceasefire proposal from Egypt and Qatar did not stop Israel from continuing its military operation in Rafah, even as Jerusalem agreed to send a delegation to Cairo to discuss the deal. Quote, the war cabinet decided Israel will continue its operation in Rafah in order to apply military pressure on Hamas so as to advance the release of our hostages and achieve other objectives of the war, the prime minister's office said. While the Hamas proposal is far from meeting Israel's core demands, Israel will dispatch a ranking delegation to Egypt in an effort to maximize the possibility of reaching an agreement on terms acceptable to Israel, the prime minister's office added. U.S. National Security Communication Advisor John Kirby confirmed for reporters in Washington that Hamas had accepted a proposal that the Biden administration was studying. CIA Director William Burns, quote, is looking at that response. He's talking to the Israelis about it, and we'll see where it goes, Kirby said. Hopefully, whatever is in this thing can lead to those hostages getting out real soon with their families where they need to be, given that each new day passes, their lives get further at risk. So time is really of the essence here. An official briefed on the ceasefire talks said that Hamas agreed to the latest proposal made by Israel on April 27th, and there have been no major changes since then. The Qatari mediators had spoken to Hamas about this on Sunday and Monday, the source said. What happens next depends on Israel, the source said, adding that, quote, the ball is in Israel's court. The deal Hamas agreed to, however, was not one seen or approved by Israel and was a modified version of a framework that had been under discussion in Cairo. An Israeli official, speaking on condition of anonymity, said the proposal that Hamas had accepted was a watered-down version of an Egyptian offer and included elements that Israel could not accept. This would appear to be a ruse intended to make Israel look like the side refusing a deal, said the Israeli official. Oh. I wonder where they would come up with a trick like that. Hamas's statement comes after intense negotiations in Cairo on Sunday involving Egyptian and Qatari delegations along with CIA Director William Burns. He then traveled to Doha to consult with Qatari Prime Minister Mohammed Al-Thani and is expected to visit Israel this week. An American source told the Jerusalem Post on Monday, quote, essentially the talks fell through. They were on life support, which is what prompted Bill Burns to get on a plane and go to Qatar. Both the Americans and the Qataris, in a display of shared responsibility, engaged in a heavy pressure and diplomacy campaign, striving to breathe life back into the framework of an agreement. The American source further emphasized that we are at a very delicate and sensitive point in time, underscoring the mutual understanding of the situation. The Americans and the Qataris are keeping pressure on both sides to build the framework that has been agreed upon. Taher al-Nono, a Hamas official and advisor to Haniya, told Reuters that the proposal met the group's demands, including reconstruction efforts in Gaza, the return of displaced Palestinians, and a swap of Israeli hostages for Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails. The Hamas deputy chief in Gaza, Khalil al-Haya, told Al Jazeera Television that the proposal included three phases, each of 6 weeks, with Israel to pull its troops out of Gaza in the second phase. In the first phase, lasting 42 days, Hamas would release 33 hostages, and Israel would partially withdraw troops from Gaza while allowing Palestinians to return from the south to the north. In the second phase, lasting 42 days, there would be an agreement to restore sustainable calm to Gaza, which would include a withdrawal of most of the IDF troops. Phase 3 would see a complete exchange of remaining hostages, including those who are deceased, along with the implementation of a reconstruction plan overseen by Qatar, Egypt, and the United Nations. Israel would also lift its restrictions on the entry of goods into the enclave. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas called on the international community Monday to pressure Israel to commit to a proposal for a ceasefire in Gaza mediated by Egypt and Qatar, Palestinian official news agency WAFA reported. Just before Hamas's announcement on Monday, U.S. President Joe Biden spoke with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for half an hour. In their call, Biden updated Netanyahu, quote, on efforts to secure a hostage deal, including through ongoing talks today in Doha, Qatar. The White House said the prime minister agreed to ensure the Kerem Shalom crossing is open for humanitarian assistance for those in need, and the president reiterated his clear position on Rafah, the White House explained. At issue had been Hamas's insistence on a permanent ceasefire, with Israel insisting it could only accept a pause to the war because it was determined to conduct a military operation in Rafah to destroy the remaining Hamas battalions there. Earlier on Monday, the IDF began to evacuate Palestinians from Rafah, prompting a massive international outcry. European Union Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell wrote on Twitter, that Israel's evacuation orders to civilians in Rafah portend the worst. More war and famine. It is unacceptable. Israel must renounce its ground offensive, he stated, adding that the EU and the international community can and must act to prevent such a scenario. French Foreign Minister Catherine Colonna stressed on X her country's opposition to the Rafah operation, explaining that French President Emmanuel Macron had explained this to Netanyahu when the two spoke on Sunday. Maybe the French, you know, they've been talking about sending troops to Ukraine. Maybe the French should send some troops to Israel. Maybe do that. The French Foreign Ministry told reporters that a forced displacement of a civilian population constitutes a war crime under international law. Belgian Vice Premier Petra de Sutter warned that a Rafah invasion will lead to a massacre. Belgium is working on further sanctions against Israel, she wrote in a post on Twitter. De Sutter has been a fierce and early critic of Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza that began on October 7th, calling already in November for sanctions against the Jewish state. The international community, including the United States, fears a Rafah operation would lead to a humanitarian disaster for the over 1.3 million Palestinians located there, many of whom sought shelter there to escape Israeli bombardments in northern Gaza at the start of the war. The United Nations Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, which is the main organization that services Palestinian refugees, wrote on Twitter that an Israeli offensive in Rafah would mean more civilian suffering and deaths. The consequences would be devastating for 1.4 million people. UNRWA is not evacuating Palestinians from Rafah, it stressed, adding that the agency will maintain a presence in Rafah as long as possible and will continue providing life-saving aid to people. Kirby said that the president was very direct and consistent on this topic and had spoken of it in his conversation with Netanyahu. We don't want to see major ground operations in Rafah that put these people at greater risk, Kirby said. Now, it's my understanding that the operation in Rafah has already begun. And so much for that, right? 217-688-1433. If you'd like to be on the program, and the more you talk, the less I have to. So please do give us a call. And so, you know, one of the things that I think is happening sort of as a consequence of the anti-Israel protests, which is, you know, look, again, I said it before, I'll say it again. I'm not a big fan of all the policies of the Israeli state. But I am a big fan of leftists losing. When leftists are losing, I really get enthusiastic about that. And so they're losing in big ways. It's not just that they're getting their butts kicked by police and getting removed from places. MIT just became the first elite university to ban diversity statements. In what's likely to be a watershed moment, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology has ended the use of diversity statements for hiring faculty, making it the first elite private university to backtrack on the practice that has been roundly criticized as a political litmus test. On Saturday, an MIT spokesperson confirmed in an email that requests for a statement on diversity will no longer be part of applications for any faculty positions at MIT, adding that the decision was made by embattled MIT President Sally Kornbluth with the support of the provost chancellor and all six academic deans. The decision marks an inflection point in the battle over diversity, equity, and inclusion in higher education. But since at least the late 2010s, diversity statements have been ubiquitous in hiring faculty, sometimes carrying serious weight in the selection process. As one dean at Emory University put it while describing her approach to hiring, quote, diversity statement, then dossier. MIT embraced the diversity statement trend. In late 2023, the university's Department of Nuclear Science and Engineering sought an assistant professor, quote, in fields from fundamental nuclear science that to practical application of nuclear technology and energy security and quantum engineering. Applicants were required to submit a, quote, statement regarding their views on diversity, inclusion, and belonging, including past and current contributions, as well as their vision and plans for the future in these areas. Such statements have long been controversial, and the basic argument against them is simple. Diversity, equity, and inclusion has come to connote a set of controversial views about identity, power, and oppression. Universities, which require scholars to, quote, demonstrate their commitment to DEI, can easily invite ideological screening as well as potentially unlawful viewpoint discrimination. Many groups thus oppose the diversity statements on the grounds of academic freedom and free expression. At MIT, these arguments seem to have won the day. In a statement provided to the author of this piece via email, President Kornbluth states, "We can build an inclusive environment in many ways, but compelled statements impinge on freedom of expression, and they don't work." This is momentous. The pushback against diversity statements has succeeded almost exclusively at public universities in red states, encouraged or enacted by lawmakers. Conservative states such as Florida, Texas, and Utah have passed laws banning diversity statements at state universities. Some appointed state university leaders, such as University of North Carolina Board of Governors, have also banned the practice. The decision at MIT is different. Reform from within, prompted by a university president alongside deans and provosts at a private institution. It's very possible that more private universities and state universities in blue states will eventually follow MIT's lead for one basic reason. A significant number of faculty from across the political spectrum simply cannot stand mandatory DEI statements. Last month, Harvard Law School's Randall Kennedy, a self-described scholar on the left committed to struggles for social justice, described the general sentiment, quote, "It would be hard to overstate the degree to which many academics at Harvard feel and beyond feel intense and growing resentment against the DEI enterprise because of features that are perhaps most evident in the demand for DEI statements." Let's hope Kennedy and his colleagues learn from MIT's example and take their indignation seriously. After all, it's more than a narrow issue of free expression and compelled speech. Diversity statements don't merely create an orthodoxy. They create a uniquely bad orthodoxy, one that is corrosive to civil life and inimical to true higher education. And so that is John Saylor over at Unheard, H-E-R-D. And I don't think that this is them coming around, frankly. Let me just go look up the last name, Kornbluth, and see if it's see if that rhymes with anything. So I don't know Yeah. So, yeah, she is actually Jewish, the Kornbluth woman. And so, you know, she's taking away the left. She's taking this away from the left as punishment for the Israeli protests is what's going on. And that's hilarious, right? Because, of course, you know, Jewish activists, they love the whole diversity thing. They've been, you know, they're primarily responsible for it. But they're like, OK, left wingers, like, we're going to take away all the goodies that we've given you now because you're not doing what we want. And I find that profoundly amusing, you know. Here's the other thing that they're getting taken away from them. They're not going to have their commencement ceremony. Donald Trump mentioned that in the statement that I played for you earlier. Columbia University cancels university-wide commencement ceremony after weeks of protests on campus. Pro-Palestinian protests spouted on campus on April 17th when students pitched about 50 tents while demanding a ceasefire in Gaza and insisting the university divest from companies that they say could be profiting from the war. Columbia University will replace its university-wide commencement ceremony on May 15th with smaller-scale school-based celebrations. University officials announced Monday after weeks of pro-Palestinian and counter-protests on campus. The Ivy League school in New York City said the decision was made after discussions with student leaders. Security concerns were the main reason behind the decision, a university official told ABC News. Our students emphasize that these smaller-scale school-based celebrations are most meaningful to them and their families, the university said Monday. They are eager to cross the stage to applause and family pride and hear from their school's invited guest speakers. As a result, we will focus our resources on those school ceremonies and keeping them safe, respectful, and running smoothly. That's right. See, this is just, we're doing this because it's better, right? We're not punishing you. As a result, students will be honored individually alongside their peers at smaller ceremonies. Class days and school ceremonies celebrated on the South Lawn of the Morningside campus have also been relocated to Columbia's Baker Athletics Complex. These past few weeks have been incredibly difficult for our community. Just as we are focused on making our graduation experience truly special, we continue to solicit student feedback and are looking at the possibility of a festive event on May 15th to take the place of large formal ceremonies, university officials said. We are eager to all come together for our graduates and celebrate our fellow Columbians as they and we look ahead to the future, they said. Come May 15th, graduation ceremonies for the Journalism School, the College of Physicians and Surgeons, Barnard College, and the School of Arts will take place at different times at different locations, according to a schedule released by Columbia. The other school-based ceremonies will take place throughout the week as well. Pro-Palestinian protests... You just said this. The arrest, New York City police officers clad in riot gear arrived on campus last Tuesday evening at the request of university administrators and forced their way into the barricaded Hamilton Hall, which protesters had taken over and renamed Hinds Hall after a 6-year-old Palestinian girl who was killed in Gaza. The encampment was cleared with more than 100 people arrested. The arrests have shaken confidence in University President Manoush Shafiq among some students and faculty members at Columbia. In a statement asking for New York police assistance to clear Hamilton Hall, she said the occupation, quote, left us no choice. In its request for police assistance, Columbia asked the police department to stay on campus until at least May 17th, 2 days after commencement. A source at the university said Columbia was rethinking its commencement ceremony after a meeting with the top university leaders on Friday. Two members of the student government said administrators indicated they are not sure they can hold a commencement ceremony on the main Morningside Heights campus in Manhattan because of security concerns. Protests similar to the one at Columbia quickly appeared at college campuses across the country, concerning administrators about their commencement ceremonies as well. On Saturday, students waved Palestinian flags during the University of Michigan's commencement. Banners from the sky displayed messages such as "Divest from Israel now, free Palestine, and we stand with Israeli Jewish lives matter." In a statement issued afterwards, the university's Assistant Vice President for Public Affairs, Colleen Mastany, said about 75 protesters gathered staged a demonstration at the beginning of the program by walking up to the main aisle and chanting. Public safety personnel escorted them to the rear of the stadium, where they stayed until commencement ended. There were no arrests, Mastoni said in a statement. Last month, the University of Southern California in Los Angeles said it was canceling its main commencement ceremony, scheduled for this Friday, which was to have included a keynote address from alumnus John M. Chu, director of Crazy Rich Asians, and a presentation of honorary degrees to tennis star Billie Jean King and others. The university previously canceled a commencement speech by a Muslim valedictorian following controversy over her social media post about Israel's war in Gaza, but USC said it would still host individual school commencement ceremonies and other related events. So that's what happens. You know, you go, you mess with these people, and then, you know, they take everything away from you. 217-688-1433 if you'd like to be on the program. And the more you talk, the less I have to. So please do give us a call. There's an American being detained in Russia. He's apparently accused of stealing. What you're doing in Russia right now as an American soldier, you know, maybe stealing was not the dumbest of your decisions in that period of time that you made that trip. Let's hear what MSNBC has to say about it. They're always, you know, giving us the straight dope on Russia, of course.
Charges based off some.
Can we go back to the beginning of the story, please? There we go.
U.S. officials say a U.S. soldier is detained in Russia, was detained over the weekend. He was stationed in Korea, traveled to Russia on his own accord. The soldier is accused of stealing. And joining us now is NBC News Pentagon correspondent Courtney Kuby. So, Courtney, what do we know about this soldier and why is he being detained?
We don't know a whole lot. So we know that he is accused, as you said, Anna, of stealing. But what we don't know is if those are actual charges based off something that he did, or if he was detained for, frankly, no other reason than he was an American and a soldier who happened to be in Russia. Now, he went there from, he traveled to Russia from Korea, where he was stationed. He's an enlisted soldier in the U.S. Army, and he traveled there on his own. He was not on any kind of an official travel, but he was there on his own. We are also now told, according to officials familiar with this case, that he went there of his own without notifying his superiors of this travel. So, again, he has been detained. We don't know where he's being held. We're still trying to figure a lot of these details out, but of course, we have watched as Americans have been detained in Russia for the last several years. There are several who are still being held now. So the officials we're speaking to about this are very concerned about his safety, and they continue to warn Americans not to travel to Russia, Anna.
Okay. Okay. So this is pretty funny, frankly. Like, that entire segment served no other purpose than as a denial. Like, the State Department probably put that piece together, right? How many times, you know, I should have kept track of it, but how
we
many,
began this
hey,
hour
shut your stupid
court-
mouth. Shut up, NBC, MSNBC, you idiots. They probably said it four or five times, right? He went there on his own volition. He was not ordered. It wasn't official business. The soldier is not there for the United States government. He's just some guy who went from Korea to Russia, and I don't know why he did it. The State Department says he didn't do it. He's not a criminal. He's not over there. Russia detains people for no reason. This is not State Department business. He's not a spy. The guy better hope that he's only charged with stealing, right? Which is, you know, I don't know what the punishment for theft is in Russia, but I imagine it's not minor, right? You're not allowed to, you know, in Russia, they have a, they're clever. Like, they put criminals in jail and they keep them there. We don't do that in the United States. The Russians, they don't like crime. They don't take that stuff, you know? So he was stationed in Korea and he's like, you know what? I think, you know, I've been watching the news and maybe I'll just go and, you know, put my uniform on and go to Russia. I don't know if he's wearing his uniform. Probably not, you know? But, like, what did you think was going to happen? You think this is going to go well? Like, you're an American soldier, you go to Russia? You know, if you want to, like, go to Russia, like, I'm not saying that that's actually a bad idea, generally speaking, but if you're, like, an active-duty U.S. military serviceman, and then you go to Russia and then you commit a crime, like, you know, that might be considered dumb by some people. Let's go check on our, stream chats. Let's see here. Yeah. Yeah, he's going to, as somebody said in the chat over here, he said that he's going to get court-martialed. That's probably true. And so, you know, we wish the guy the best of luck. We don't want any hostility with our Russian friends. We don't want American soldiers getting in trouble. We just want everybody to sort of like, you know, pull it together and maybe not be complete idiots. But that's a little bit much to ask for these days, I guess. You know, trying to expect people to be sane, probably not going to work out. Just not going to go. And so I'll close out. I'll do one more piece here. This is from Victor Davis Hanson over at American Greatness. I don't know. So when I pulled this up, this looked very interesting. And then I just realized it's categorized under anti-Semitism. And so might not be as genius as I thought it was from the title. But the title sounds good. It's The End of Old Left-Wing Mythology. So I'd love to see the end of old left-wing mythologies. Let's get rid of those things because they're toxic and dangerous. But, you know, complaining about anti-Semitism is up there. So let's see what happens. The current radical and often violent protests on mostly blue state, supposedly elite campuses have exposed in toxic fashion what the left has become. And yet, in a paradoxical fashion, the campus insanity has offered the nation some moral clarity. What's surprising is not that the demonstrators are violent and nihilist, but that they are, on the one hand, so openly and crudely anti-Semitic, racist, and anti-American, and yet, on the other hand, so passive-aggressive, narcissistic, and weepy. Nevertheless, the antics of the campus cry bullies have exploded myths that were so for so long foisted on the American people by politicos in the media. Number one, anti-Israel / anti-Semitic. We have been lectured ad nauseum that hating Israel has nothing to do with anti-Semitism. Last month has blown up that old shibboleth for good. The left makes no distinction in their eliminationist chants between Israel and Jews. Quote, go back to Poland is a homonym for the from the river from the sea, from the river to the sea. Both are shorthand for eliminating Jews. Aside from the explicit threats to kill Jews and occasional praise for Hitler and the final solution. When pro-Hamas thugs chase Jews into libraries, block their entrances on campus, and scream beat the Jew as they hit piñatas, they do not first ask Jews whether they support Israel, because they could care less. For the Islamist Middle Easterner on a student visa or green card and his youthful American student, it is enough that their targets are Jewish, period. Remember, the protests started on October 7th, not October 27th, when the IDF went into Gaza. At that point, campus and street protests merely changed from euphoric triumphalism on the news that Hamas had slaughtered, decapitated, mutilated, raped, or kidnapped hundreds of Jews, exhilarated a Cornell professor gushed off the carnage, to furor and violence. So after 3 weeks of celebrating dead Jews, the street protests grew furious only when the IDF finally began fighting back and destroying Hamas, even as its terrorists cowardly hid beneath mosques, hospitals, and schools to ensure enough collateral damage to incite pro-Hamas Western throngs. Number two, pro-Palestinian, pro-Hamas. This is so funny. I'll finish it just because I started it, but I used to like Victor Davis Hanson. And, you know, I'm not surprised that he's like, yeah, screw those leftists. But you're talking about the destruction of left-wing myths and what you're like, yeah, you're like, oh, well, now that we're destroying the left-wing myths, everybody knows that, like, it's totally right-wing to support Israel unconditionally. No, I'm a nationalist, actually. Like, I actually don't think that, you know, I'm not going to go out of my way to help Israel. Like, I don't really think that... I don't think that the right-wing thing to do is be like, yeah, yeah, Israel, Israel, Israel. I don't think that that's the case at all. And it's kind of, and it's debasing, right? It's like, you're actually lowering, you know, Victor Davis Hanson, you know anything about him, you know, he comes on, when he's talking about other subject matter, he comes across, he's a sincere intellectual, he's a smart guy, and he's like, yeah, look at me, you take one look at me, and you know I'm smart, and then I start talking, and you're like, wow, that's the voice of a sophisticated man. And now he's like, they're a bunch of racists. And you just start sounding like a bunch of idiots, you know. Now, they are, you know, they are racist. Like, they hate white people, right? And they've been saying that for a very long time, and nobody cared. And then they were like, yeah, Israel sucks. And you're like, hey, wait a second, okay? Look, those white people over there, you're not allowed to hate those people, you understand? This is garbage. I'm not going to read it. I'm not going to do it. And so It's disgraceful, truth be told. Caller, you're on Surreal Politics. What can I do for your friend?
Hey, Mr. Cantwell, it's Dave. I'm just calling in. I like the topic you got. I don't know if you're going to go into it, the one that says men nowadays are looking at, you know, bailing out of the workforce.
What about it?
Oh, okay. So, yeah, that's a big topic. I see it on these. I go onto this, like, investment channels on YouTube. I go to investment channels, moving to a foreign country channels. Those channels about men that are in bad relationships and they want to get out of relationships altogether for the rest of their life and go monk mode, they're talking about divesting from work in our society, North America generally, because they're saying that it's all been, a lot of the people, I'm saying, the ones that have fallen under the, you know, it's all a scam category where, like, I would even give a personal example for myself, and I still work, by the way, but like in 2005 up here in Canada, just for reference point, things are a little more expensive up here than they might be in the larger area of the United States. But the minimum wage was about $7.50 an hour back in 2005. Well, people were starting working there at $8 an hour. And about 10 years later, they were getting like $14 an hour if they were in a pretty good position in a factory. Okay. So get this. The next year, because things are so hard to live on up here in this big city, on $14 an hour, they made, they made the minimum wage $14 an hour. So the guys who've been working 10 years trying to get up to that from $8 were basically just not getting minimum wage. You know what I'm trying to say? It's just, so apparently there was a movement like that in Asia called the laying flat movement. I think it was in China. And in Japan, I think they call it the grass eaters movement. And I don't know what they call it over here in North America, but it's, I've met people here that are on, if I may say this, on welfare. And I found out when I was laid off from my job back in 2011 for the first time, I was laid off on a job and I received government income, right? That was actually the second time I received that, but that was for other reasons I received it. But they, government income, which was social, they call it employment insurance. And employment insurance was about 75% of your pay back then, I think. And now it's down to like 51% or something. But I found out by visiting a friend that he was on social assistance and had been for at least 15 years. Maybe 20 years, maybe his whole life. I didn't realize it. And he was living in a government, a subsidized apartment, which was he was put into with his family, his mother and him. And they literally were paying like $90 a month rent when the rent up here would have been normally about $800 a month. So they're making money on the side. They're living on welfare. He ended up getting married a couple of times, divorced, kids with both the women. And the women already had kids from other guys that they've been married to. And guess what I found out? They were all on welfare, all of them. And I've been slaving away in this factory, you know, for over a decade. And I'd been on other jobs as well for going back. Well, actually, I started working full-time in 1984. So I'm just saying a lot of guys are looking around if they've been in that category of job, like maybe I was on. I'm still working that kind of job. Still getting, like, basically minimum wage. But, hey, I'm surviving. I live a pretty, you know, comfortable in my small little room in someone's basement, you know. But I think a lot of guys, from what I've seen on the internet and everything, they're just walking away from it. Even guys who are better paid or who have something. So what do you got a response to me? What do you think?
I think that what all the left-wing economic programs do is disincentivize work. I mean, that's the whole entire point, right? They're trying to destroy everything that is good and decent, and they're succeeding. Right. And so, like, you create a situation where somebody works their whole life to get to a certain pay rate, and then you change a law that makes all the people underneath him have the same pay rate. And then that guy's like, what have I been doing for the last decade? Right. You go and you make property uncertain with your redistributionist programs. You go and you try to rewire the economy in the name of the pandemic. All of the crazy things that they do, you know, all of these things are designed to make people want to give up on life, right? And that's what's happening, right? People are giving up on life. It's not just work, but, like, you know, it's part of what I've observed in the Grindr thing too. Okay, it's like people are giving up on relationships with the opposite sex. They're giving up on having families. They're giving up on going to work. Right? Like they're just like, how can I make my life? You know, because if I work my butt off, I'm actually not going to be rewarded like a person who works their butt off is rewarded. I'm going to be punished for that and treated like garbage. So how can I just make my life, you know, not completely intolerable is becomes the calculation. And people are like, well, I can make my life not completely intolerable by collecting a government benefit or, you know, working a low-end job and not working very hard or whatever the case may be. Everybody's like, okay, how do I just get by? You know, and that's destruction. That's the complete end of civilization is what it is, you know. And so, yeah, that's basically what's happening. They've organized the entire incentive system of, you know, Western civilization for its complete and total destruction. And it's working out fantastically. And that's what's happening.
Yeah, I was actually, that factory I worked at, it actually was a single man, apparently came from Ireland in like 1950-something, and built up this factory, which I heard he sold it for $93 million to a company. While I was working there, by the way, I worked under him for 2 years, and he sold it to a company, a huge one from California, which kept getting bigger and bigger, bought out by bigger and bigger, but I won't name whom they are, the three different, but they bought it, I heard, for $93 million off this guy. We were making, they told us in 2010, the banner year was $500 million through the 10 factories up here in Canada being the main one and the other ones in the States, $500 million profit that year with three warehouses and 10 factories. But the point is, on that note, that there was a guy... there was a guy working there for like 20 years, and he was making $6 an hour when he started, like in 1990 something. And he got $20 an hour. He was this guy who could literally build the factory from the ground up. Like I worked with him a lot. He was the lead mechanic, and so he was building everything in there. And they were, anyways. I worked with him, and I myself eventually could run the whole factory, like literally, like I could do every job and tell everybody what to do. And I was never given that position of a lead, only through forcing them. Sometimes if a lead wasn't there and there was not one there, then I could claim the rights to be paid at lead pay, which was an extra like $4 an hour for the day. But otherwise they wouldn't give it to me, even when spots became vacant and the leads either were, you know, left the job or retired. They would not allow it to be refilled. They would just keep you at your regular lower rank job and then give you the responsibility of what the lead used to do. And you might be controlling 20 people. And by the way, the place is highly volatile and it entails a lot of dangerous work with fire and volatile. So you got the picture there. Bottom line, with that, they still wanted me out of there for political reasons. Quite frankly, the company that took over, can I tell you, this is just a cliche, but the whole management, including the president, were taken over by, quite frankly, they were Jewish people. Now, I'm not just harping on these Jewish people just because of this. I'm just pointing out that what's funny about it is they literally tried to strip off all the Christmas, you know, celebrations that had gone on for 40 years at the place. And there was like a bit of a battle in management over it. And they were yelling at each other. It was quite strange. And so I was highly productive. That's the main point, I guess, what you said. I was highly productive. And they wanted to get rid of me because I spoke up about that as well. And I just directly told them, like, you know, I think this and that. And then somebody called me from California. They said, we want to speak to this fellow. So they put me on the phone. And they said, we think it's best you leave. It's just, and I said, well, listen, this. And they said, listen to me. H&R said, the guy, main guy, by the way.
Yeah.
He said,
bring it to a conclusion, my friend.
He said, we think it's best for the community that you just leave. You know, the community. So it wasn't like it was political.
Yeah, I get that. Okay, buddy. I understand. I'm going to let you go. I appreciate it. Thank you very much for the call. 217-688-1433. You call in another day, not now. You know, if you go and you, it sounded to me like what that guy's saying is that he spoke up on the job about Jewish people running the company. And if you do that and then you get fired, that's actually not news. And so I'm just going to stop. But, you know, the other point that he brought up is worthwhile. It's happening all over the place. You know, I'll give you, this is sounds like me just complaining about a vendor, but it's part of a larger thing. And I said to somebody else recently, you know, I went and I ordered vaporizer stuff from this place. And they charged me $20 for shipping. And I was like, what are you talking about, $20 for shipping? But, you know, their products were cheaper than other places. And so I'm like, fine, whatever. This is how you're making up, whatever. And then a week went by, and then I got an email from them saying, oh, we don't have the product you ordered. Would you like us to yada, yada, yada? What would you like to do? And I'm like, we'll just refund my order because I'm never going to order from you again. Like, I've never dealt with such an irresponsible vendor. You charged me $20 for shipping. I expect you to ship it right away. Like, you gave me a tracking number the next day. You gave me a tracking number. You didn't ship the product. And that's a minor thing, but it's like I'm noticing this everywhere. It's a lot worse than it was before I went to prison. Like, that, like, people just don't believe they have any obligation to do anything anymore. Like, customer service, you know, remember anybody ever, I don't think the Radio Shack even exists anymore, but, you know, you used to be able to go to Radio Shack. And Radio Shack was a place where, like, you would ask them questions about technical things, and then technical people would answer your questions, okay? Can you do that at, like, Best Buy? Can you go anywhere and, like, ask meaningful questions about the products that are being sold in any retail store? Of course not. It's a preposterous to even think that you could, as a matter of fact. Everybody's basically trying to, you know, it's the they don't make them like they used to cliche, but like it's not just about products anymore. It's like the whole entire apparatus is completely screwed. It's like, you know, the entire economy has been organized around, like, you know, a race to the bottom fundamentally, and people are understandably like, I don't want to participate. There's nothing for me to take pride in. Like, forget about the amount of money that you make, which is the other thing they're screwing you. They're like, okay, let's raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour so that everybody's making the same amount of money, and then let's make sure that you can't live on that amount of money by completely scrambling everything in the economy, and then after you can't live on the amount of money that you make, then we'll subsidize your existence. So there's no economic incentive to do anything good anymore. And then there's not even anything to take pride in. So why would anybody work? All of the reasons to do the things that people have been doing that have made civilization possible, they've destroyed all the incentives. And the consequences of that are very predictable. They're happening every single day right in front of our eyes, and it's an incredibly, disgustingly sad thing. Quadruple H White Pill asks on Honestly, Chris, what keeps you going these days? Do you think there's any hope of a future for white folks? Am I still going these days? I'm not sure I am, friend. You know, to the extent that I am, it's like, you know, honestly, I'm at the end of my rope, truth be told. And I hate to say that to you because, like, I've tried to, you know, give a more positive vision and a positive message on here. But, like, very little of what I see today, you know, gives me much in the way of hope, you know. The people who should be trying to, like, fix things are wrecking things faster than the people who are working to wreck them, as a matter of fact, you know. And so, like, you know, what are you going to do about that? I don't know, you know. But I'm going to keep on talking about it. I'll keep on showing up. You know, we're going to figure out something else to do because what we're doing ain't working. You know, that's where I'm, like, at the end of my rope, right? What we're doing isn't working. We've got to do something else. And I don't know what to do. I really don't. And so I'm just going to try new things and we'll see. And, you know, some stuff will work and some stuff will fail. And eventually we'll hit something. But that's all you can do. Okay. Like, you know, anybody who's thinking that, you know, you've figured it out, you're wrong, right? Anybody who's thinking like, oh, we'll just do this and then the problem will be solved. No. Because if that was if you found the solution to the problem, then immediately what would happen is the people who are working to destroy society would do something to counteract what you're doing. Okay, so it's a constant back and forth. It's a constant competition. It never stops. That's the human condition. There's no stasis, right? There's no stability to it. There's not supposed to be. There's a constant back and forth between, for want of a better term, the forces of good and evil. Okay, and so like, all that you can do, all that I can do anyway, is like get up in the morning and try to find the next thing. And right now I'm not particularly happy about what's going on, and I don't feel very good about it. But what am I going to do? It's not like, I talked about this before in another context, that like, it's actually like giving up actually isn't an option, right? You know, when you give up, there's not, it's not as if you give up and then you are relieved of your stress, right? You give up, everything just keeps on getting worse, right? So it's not like you get to, stop caring about the problems in the world and then your life becomes easier. That's not the way it works. Your life becomes much more difficult if you do that. And so all you can do is keep on trying. And that's what we're going to do. So we'll be back here to try again on Wednesday for the member show. And we'll be back here on Friday cursing up a storm for what's left of the radical agenda. And I'm still working on some other things, and we'll see what comes of it all. Thank you very much for tuning in. Thanks for making it possible. Go ahead, pay me, ChristopherCantwell.net/donate. GiveSendGo.com/SPM. Cash App, Edgy Chris. Send me some crypto, whatever you want. 497 Hooksett Road, Unit 312, Manchester, New Hampshire, 03104. Send me something, will you?